Good morning, Dr. Ross. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
Ross, last week we missed a topic. I wanted to start with it today. According to a study published in an online issue of Neurology, there may be a new medication that stops migraine headaches before they start.
Yeah, this is interesting. And when you talk about migraines, people say, well, they're not that common. Well, yes, they are. About 12% of people have had migraine at some stage in their life, and some people, their life is disabled by migraine. So it's not just, oh, he's having another one of his headaches, or she's in there pulling the curtains and keeping away from the family. This is a disabling condition. It's not something that should not be ridiculed. It's something that people should get some sympathy for this condition, because it's a horrible disease for some people that can ruin their life. So people can have anywhere between 1 to 8 attacks per month that can last for a few days. So imagine doing that. You're basically your whole month's wiped out, and you're tired for a few days after it as well. So not to mention the actual misery of the severe headache, but all the things that go with it. So it took 518 patients with big league migraine, and they gave them this drug called ubrogepant, so U-B-R-O-G-E-P-A-N-T, which is a drug that works by affecting a thing called the calcitonin gene-related peptide, which is a chemical, a gene that's very much interacts with blood vessel reactivity, whether your blood vessels dilate up, which is what gives you the headache, and blood vessels then constrict down inside the skull, which is what gives you a lot of the other symptoms. And basically, people who get early warning symptoms of migraines, things like light sensitivity, fortification spectra, where you get all these flashing lights before your eyes, marked fatigue, neck pain, stiffness, or dizziness. And these migraine sufferers know that these are pointers that they're going to get a migraine. They took the ubrogepant when those symptoms started, and they found a marked reduction in the progression to severe migraine. Now, this is a real game changer, because we've got similar drugs that have been developed that are injections once a month that people can have, which will stop their migraine. So it's already established and is available at the moment. But it appeals to them more to be able to take the drug when they feel the symptom coming on, rather than having to have a monthly injection. So pretty exciting stuff for people who are migraine sufferers.
For those that take PPIs, they'll know all about it. Let's talk about PPIs. Just quickly, Ross, what is a PPI?
Yeah, PPI stands for proton pump inhibitor, and what it basically does is just switch off acid production in the stomach. So for people who've suffered reflux, peptic ulcers, just general indigestion, these have been game changers for their symptoms. But like many drugs that have been on the market for a while, after the drugs have been on the market for a while, then the markers for other problems start to happen. And there's recently a class action starting off in Australia against these drugs, because there is a slight but definite increased risk for gastric cancer in people who take these on a regular basis for a long period of time, and also some evidence that it can cause what we call an interstitial nephritis, where the kidneys get inflamed and can even fail. But it's not just that. The PPIs are also associated, this has been out for about 5 years or so, double the risk for heart attack, 40% increased risk for dementia. Now, when you say 40%, that doesn't mean you've got a 40% risk of getting dementia. It's an increased risk. So if you look at an average 65-year-old person, their 10-year risk for dementia is around 10%. So a 40% increase takes them from 10% to 14%. That's 40% relative increased risk. So it's not huge, but it's still there, marker for that. And also there's an increased risk for atrial fibrillation, the heart rhythm disturbance, increased risk for osteoporosis. So these drugs are not harmless, but they're very effective for peptic ulceration and indigestion. But there are people listening to this who can't live without these drugs. If they don't take their Nexium, their Somac, their Pariet, any of these drugs that end with azole, so pantoprazole, esmeprazole, all of these sort of drugs, if they don't take them, they just get severe reflux and their life's a misery. So what I say to people in this situation is that the best thing to do is to take the toned-down version, which are called H2 blockers, and these are drugs like Tarzac, Nizac, Famotidine, which basically turn the volume down on acid production in the stomach, but don't switch it off. So there's no markers in these people of these sort of things like the gastric cancer or the kidney problems or the increased risk of vascular disease, because we know that PPIs damage the lining of blood vessels, which is why we get the heart attack, the Alzheimer's, etc. So I say to people, take 300 milligrams of one of these drugs, Tarzac, Nizac. If you get most of your reflux in the evening, take it in the evening. If you get most in the morning, take it in the morning. And then use your PPI drug as a backup if you get breakthrough reflux. So if you had one of these drugs once or twice a week, I can't imagine that's going to hurt you. It's just people who take it every day. It's a bit analogous to the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that people take, and which for their arthritic pain or aches and pain somewhere, you take them every day, you damage your kidneys, you damage your gut, you put up your blood pressure. But if you took them every now and then, it's not going to hurt you at all.
If you've been taking PPIs on a regular basis and you stop, do you recover from any damage that it's done to your system? Or is it a case of the damage is already done?
It may be. And see, this is the problem with any condition, with any person. You asked before about, can you reverse type 2 diabetes? Some people, yes. Many people, no. And so it could be that if people are listening to this and say, gee, I've been on Nexium for 10 years, I better stop. Now, that's dangerous. You must speak to your doctor about it. I'm not your doctor. Your GP is your doctor. You must go there first and discuss it with them. Don't say, I heard that Walker bloke and he told me I have to stop my pills. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is you need to have a discussion with your GP. And I think the best way is what I've suggested. But even then, there are people who do that and their reflux becomes so bad that you've got to look at the risk of the side effects of the drugs versus the benefits you get from being on the drugs. And if the damage is already done, well, it still can be treated. It's not as if there's nothing that can be done for you. But I'm just saying, just look at your own individual circumstance and discuss it with your doctor.
So you're talking about it's Tarzac and Nizac, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Nizitidine is the proper name for the drug, but they're just called Tarzac, Nizac or something. And you need a script for it. So you go to your GP and you get a script for 30, you get 30 in the box and it repeats on it. But I just think, I personally believe they're safer than being on the PPIs long term, which is borne out by all the evidence.
Are both those drugs readily available in Australia now?
Oh, yeah. People remember the old style drug Zantac, which has now been taken off the market for reasons I think was a bit spurious, but Zantac's no longer available. But these drugs are very similar and do similar sort of thing. And also, you can have the fallback of using things like Gaviscon and Mylanta if you get some bad reflux as well. So there's a lot of things you can do. But see, the big problem with people who get a lot of reflux, I still believe everyone deserves one gastroscopy who gets significant reflux, because you've got to make sure, A, you don't have a Helicobacter infection, because Helicobacter infections, if left in the stomach after 10 or 15 years, can become cancerous as well, regardless of PPIs. And there's another thing at the lower end of the esophagus, which is a change in the lining called Barrett's esophagitis. And again, Barrett's esophagitis, if it's not managed properly, can turn into esophageal cancer. So these things do need to be managed. So don't just say, I've got bad reflux, I'm taking Nexium. I've got bad reflux, I want to know what the cause is.
Dr. Ross, I can't believe that they come up with a name for everything, but they have. They've come up with a name for Sleep-tember. Yes, it's September and it's Sleep-tember. Now, look, you and I have talked about it over the years, how important sleep is to us. And the older we get, the more important sleep becomes to us. But what are some of the biggest lifestyle factors contributing to poor sleep? I mean, I know that there are people that listen to this radio station that cannot sleep of a night time. And that's why they listen to the radio station. They just simply can't sleep, Ross.
Yeah, and let me make the point that sleep disorders are unbelievably common. 30% of the population suffer some degree of insomnia. I think all adult males have a degree of sleep apnea. All postmenopausal females have a degree of sleep apnea, which is where the airway closes when you get into a deep sleep. And then there's all the other things, restless leg syndrome, periodic leg movements, these weird REM disorders where you have funny dreams and a whole lot of stuff. And I think one of the big things is modern living. So there's things that I say we should be avoiding before sleep, in a few hours before sleep, which is going to help. So we've got to develop good sleep hygiene. So I'll go through the things we should avoid, the things we should encourage. But let me just make the point that 70% of people are what we call larks, which means go to bed early, wake up early, they're genetically primed to do so. 30% of night owls go to bed late, wake up late. And you've really got to sleep to what your genetic makeup is. And our society is geared for larks because we wake up early-ish, 6 to 7 o'clock, start work by about 9 o'clock by the time you get there with driving and getting ready. And then you've finished at 5. Whereas the night owls are more the restaurateurs and the musicians because they just don't want to get up early. And so they're more attracted to those jobs. But generally, well, the points I give to people are, firstly, you've got to prepare for sleep. So the number one thing is whatever relationship issues you might be having, resolve them before you go to sleep. Don't go to bed angry, number one. Number two, don't do heavy exercise in the 2 hours before sleep. So don't go for a run because it heats up your body temperature, makes it hard to get sleep. Don't eat in the 2 hours before sleeping. Don't see alcohol as a sedative because that might get you off to sleep, but it disrupts your sleeping patterns. And any stimulants like coffee or any, obviously, illegal drugs people shouldn't be using, that also screws around your sleep. And even some drugs do. And you see, there's this common misconception that people should take their statin drugs in the evening, like Lipitor or Crestor. They're long-acting. You take them in the morning and they don't tend to affect your sleep as much, as one example. And one of the worst things you could do is fall asleep in front of the TV or with the radio on or with the light on. So they're the things you should avoid. But the things you should encourage before you go to sleep, reading. So I give you any of my medical journals, you'll be asleep in 5 seconds. A warm bath or a shower because that cools the body down when you get out. So as your temperature's decreasing, you get to sleep better. A warm, non-caffeine-based drink during the hour before sleep. Meditation, relaxation tapes. And one of the best things you can do before you go to sleep, if you have the chance to do it, is lovemaking. And I've got to tell you a very funny story, which the listeners will enjoy. I used to, I've been doing radio now for 25 years, and so I was doing a segment one Sunday night, and this caller, Susan, rang in and said, Doctor, you said you shouldn't be exercising before sleep, but what about lovemaking? I said, oh, no, totally different exercise. It releases different chemicals in the brain. It's a very good thing to do before you go to sleep as opposed to going for a run. She said, thank you, Doctor. My husband will be very happy. So anyhow, I'm driving home, and every time I drive home, I always give my wife a call. And she said, how did you like Susan? I said, oh, she seemed like a nice lady. She said, it was me, you idiot. And she disguised her voice. And I said to her, well, at least I gave the right answer. I thought you'd enjoy that one. So the key points to getting good sleep are firstly the timing. So you should go to bed in the evening and wake up at the same time in the morning consistently. So don't have haphazard sleeping habits. So sleep regularity is really important to develop good sleep habits. Number two is the timing of sleep. So you need, on average, somewhere between 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night. Now, again, as we get older, you get up and do the middle of the night wee and all of those sort of things. But if you can get back to sleep quickly, it doesn't really matter. So I wake up at the end of every sleep cycle, which goes for 90 minutes. So I wake up 4 or 5 times a night and just roll over and go back to sleep. That's fine because it's getting into that deep sleep in the middle of sleep and then you dream just before you wake up. It's the deep sleep that rejuvenates the body for the next day. And I say to people, sleep in a cool, dark environment. So you don't want to sleep in a hot environment because it heats your body up, you don't get to sleep, and you want it as dark as possible. And another thing is get all electronics out of the bedroom. You wouldn't believe this, Brent, but some people have a television in their bedroom. It's just absolutely dreadful because of all the electromagnetic radiation. And some people sleep with their mobile phones under their pillow. You're not that important. Don't use your mobile phones there. And don't have electronics in the bedroom like, well, I'm talking about things like iPads and computers, because that also screws around your sleeping pattern and also minimise the noise if you possibly can. Once you do all of those things, there are still ingrained insomniacs who just don't sleep well. So there are some natural sleeping products that are reasonable. And again, I can't mention products on air. And then there are definite sleeping pills as opposed to sedatives. So things like temazepam is a sedative. It is not a sleeping pill. So it just sedates you, but it doesn't regulate better sleep. But there's a few newer drugs on the market. So there's a thing called suvorexant, which is a thing called an orexin inhibitor, which I think is a very good sleeping pill. But again, I don't think people should be using sleeping pills every night unless they're just high-grade industrial-strength insomniacs. But the worst thing for you is not occasionally using a sleeping pill. The worst thing for you is getting bad sleep. So I encourage everybody to do everything they can to maintain their sleep hygiene first and foremost, and sparingly use sleeping pills when you need to. But again, I don't want people to just be lying there staring at the ceiling all night and not sleeping, because that's what's going to screw the brain around and markedly increase your risk for health problems as you get older. And let me also say, too much sleep is not good for you either. So sleeping more than 8 hours a day doesn't give you any extra benefit. And in fact, people that sleep for more than, say, nine to 10 hours a day tend to have worse health outcomes. But I think it might be more the reason why they need that amount of sleep.
What about a gentle walk? I know you said you don't exercise, you don't go for a run, but what about a gentle walk before bedtime? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, I don't think it helps. I think if you look, I think for, especially for us old farts, you know, people 50 plus, the best time to exercise is between 2 to 6 in the afternoon.
What about lying there for hours? You said you get up, you go to the toilet. I mean, what about if you get up, you go to the toilet and something's worrying you and you come back and you go to bed and you just cannot get back to sleep and you are lying there and you are lying there and you're watching the clock. It's gone from 3 to 3.30, from 3.30 to 4, from 4 to 4.30. What do you do in that situation?
You wouldn't lie there for any more than about 20 minutes to a half an hour. I mean, if you did, you'd have to get up, go into another room, read a gentle book, not a thriller, and just do something else to get your mind off it. Don't go and eat. Don't go and drink anything. Just go and sit there and gently read a book or do something that's going to take your mind off the fact that you can't get to sleep. But if you lie there and try to get to sleep, you will not get to sleep.
What about sleeping in the middle of the day? We call it a nana nap. Do you catch up on sleep? If you've had a lousy night's sleep, can you have an hour or half an hour in the afternoon and that will do you that'll be a good thing for you?
Yep. Look, I think a 20-minute to half an hour sleep, and no more than that. The studies have shown beyond a doubt, a study of 23,000 Greeks showed that those who had an afternoon sleep had a 40% reduction in cardiovascular disease compared with the people that didn't have the sleep. So I encourage everyone to, if they like, if they got the opportunity, to have a short nap in the afternoon. And that should be part of your 7 to 8 hours a night. So you may only need, if you had that half an hour, you may only need, say, 7 hours sleep when you go to bed at night.
You talked about sleeping tablets. What about natural supplements? Forget the sleeping tablets. People don't like taking tablets. There are many people like that. What about natural supplements for people?
Yeah. There's quite a few good herbal supplements. And again, I can't mention any particular product, but I I'm not a great sleeper, and I certainly take a natural supplement every night. That has just different natural sedatives in it, and they're not that powerful, but they do help with sleep.
Is this valerian? Is that one particular thing that people can look for?
Valerian, Sisyphus, magnesium, there's a whole lot of things. A lot of these products are now coming out with triple strength of these different products.
Should you get to the stage, though, where you rely on these supplements on long-term, that's probably not a good thing?
Oh, I don't think it hurts. I think, look, the worst thing to me, and I think this is where we've got to make the point, the worst thing is poor sleep. The worst thing is not taking supplements or using the occasional sleeping pill. It's poor sleep.
How important is a pillow in sleeping, Ross?
Oh, look, I think it's very important. I mean, I like a good rock-hard pillow, and I just bought one recently when I was overseas, which is terrific. It's like sleeping on a brick. But that's good for me. Some people don't like that. Some people prefer really soft pillows. And I think it's like everything. You find out what works for you and you do it.
What symptoms might we experience, apart from being in a bad mood, if we don't get enough sleep, in reference to how harmful is this to our long-term health?
Look, it's like being drunk. It's very bad for you. And in fact, they've shown that people that have sleep apnea, we all heard about the micro sleeps with sleep apnea, and you know how bad your sleep's been by when you wake up in the morning, regardless of what the cause is for the bad sleep, you feel unrefreshed. You look at your watch and say, I've been asleep for 7 hours. I really need another 2 hours. And that's where you may need to start thinking about seeing a sleep physician who can sort out your sleeping problem.
If you're having trouble with your sleep, you really do need to see someone, don't you? And these are the experts that you go and talk to.
Yeah, they deal with this stuff all the time. So you should not suffer in silence, which is what I'm saying. And sleep disorders are so common. So many people are struggling with their sleep. So please go and see your GP, talk to your GP about it, and possibly get referral to a sleep physician.
How bad is shift work for sleepers?
Oh, it's very bad. And in fact, we've shown beyond a doubt that shift work, international travellers or international pilots and flight attendants, they get many more health problems. And I think part of the reasons for that, not just the cosmic radiation from the plane, but also the fact their sleep cycle is so disordered that it really creates the havoc with their hormones, havoc with everything. So, no, shift work is not good for you. But unfortunately, the way our society works, we do have a 24/7 society where we do need people to do shifts.
Why, as we get older, do we need less sleep?
I just think that's how the body is. Our bodies were only designed to work well for 30, 40 years wandering around jungle with a spear. So I just think when we get into our 50s and 60s, we just don't need to have as much sleep to rejuvenate ourselves during the day. But it's not always the case for everybody. So again, see, the parameter is A, how you feel when you wake up in the morning, and B, how you function throughout the day. So if you're finding that you're waking unrefreshed, you're sitting there to sit down and watch your favourite television show in the evening and you sleep within 5 seconds, you've got a big problem that needs to be sorted out.
It's funny you were talking about that, and I'm thinking, how many times have I fallen asleep in front of the TV? I do have a TV in the room. I've got the mobile phone by the bedside on a charger. Ross, I'm going tick, 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 tick. I've got a problem, haven't I?
Well, I think you should make some minor adjustments with some of those things, mate.
All right, Ross. Thank you, mate. I hope you sleep well tonight.
So do I. Great to talk to you. Thanks, mate.
Thanks, Ross. See you, mate. Bye-bye.